All right, so as Matt has said, this year is probably, in one sense, one of the most exciting, exhilarating, but nerve-wracking years if you're in the business of multilateralism. We have the sustainability goals, and I will answer the question, are there too many? And I think the answer is no. You actually, when you sit down and read them, realize that we need to aspire in pretty much every aspect of society and economy and how we deal with the environment, but I'll come back to that. What I really wanted just to give you is a few messages around how we're going to do business in the future, because it will be very different. And when we're thinking about a sustainability check, it is useful to understand that we have to have baselines. We have to have, in a sense, an aspirational or realizable goal. And then we have to have the wherewithal to get there. And there is plenty of room for innovation. There's plenty of room for science. And the first place where we need, I would say, better science, maybe not better science in the traditional way, but a better understanding of science and traditional knowledge and local knowledge and so forth, is in the idea of integration. So the sustainability goals have three pretty much underpinning ideas, one of which, of course, is universality, which comes as a big shock, in fact, to many countries, including the OECD countries, that as the economy has been evolving over the last 5 years, we have growing inequality. We have the signs that will take us potentially in the wrong direction. And so the sustainable goals are as much for the developed world as they are for the developing world. So that universality is really a crucial underpinning. We're all in the same boat together. That the other side of it is about integration. We've seen over the years that the silo thinking of different policies has actually led to not only unintended consequences, but in some cases, policies literally being knocked off course, whilst, you know, governments are trying their very best in one area, another particularly perverse set of scenarios might actually take it even further in the wrong direction. I'm thinking here of subsidies and some of the fiscal instruments that we have. So the sort of the idea of leaving no one behind, making sure we address equity and prosperity, and in the end, trying to increase capital in all its forms, is at the core of what the Sustainable Development Goals are about. A quick global snapshot. We've obviously seen a massive population explosion. Well, maybe not explosion, but certainly a massive increase, certainly over my lifetime. We've seen generically changes in the environment that are drivers towards what will inevitably be something that will be at the heart of the discussions in Paris. So an increase in the temperatures of the oceans. We've had people moving towards the cities. And it's fascinating because when we look more and more at why people are moving into cities, of course it's about employment. But now we see displacement, internal displacement of people away from their land for a multiple set of reasons. Often it's because of lack of access to land and land ownership, but it is also lack of water, the fact that soils are losing their productivity, and so forth. So those multiple reasons are sort of wrapped up into a mass migration towards the urban centres. And now, of course, it's leading to, as we have now, 21 million people growing up to 60 million if you take the whole of the Middle East region, who are displaced or essentially either internally or externally. At the same time, we have premature deaths, avoidable deaths from air pollution, both indoor and outdoor. And we see that more and more pressure is being put on planet Earth. So we have 40% of the planet is used for our plant production. Yes, we have been able to protect a lot of land, to conserve land. But of course, when we look at the land that we have, we see that nearly a quarter of the soils that we have are degraded. So land degradation is a really massive problem. And it is something that is within the Sustainable Development Goals to reverse the trend. A lot of water problems, and we'll have a really good talk, I'm sure, from colleagues here, and discussions around water, but the idea that much of our wastewater still goes into rivers and lakes untreated is something, again, at the core of the Sustainable Development Goals. And out in oceans, we have a lot of places which are unprotected from fisheries, from coastal erosion, but also from removal of infrastructure, such as coral reefs, for building. So we can take a diagnosis, and so we can give a diagnosis that, yes, all over the planet, we can encounter unhealthy environments. We can also say, though, that we see growing impacts of climate change, not only in temperature increases and sea level rise, but also the way that the seasons are affected. And now we see very, very different meteorology. We see different rainfall patterns. For example, in Kenya, we're waiting on an El Nino event to really impact, and it will and has already started, to impact not only the local areas around Nairobi, but also all the way out into the rural areas, where we have a differentiation between a drought in one part of the country and almost flood capacity overwhelmed in another. So infrastructure is just unable in many parts of the world to deal with these background changes and event structures. We have vulnerable states. You're going to hear a lot about that going into the discussions in Paris. We'll see that there will be a divided world, hopefully, that will come together around, can we stick to a trajectory that takes us on a pathway to the 2-degree world? And of course, the small island states would want us to be on a trajectory towards 1.5 degrees, in the sense that level of comfort is really what they're seeking out of any Paris Agreement. And then, more generally, the functioning of the planet Earth. I think in a few days' time, you're going to see a number coming out of the World Meteorological Organization, which tells us that not only have we exceeded 400 parts per million in terms of carbon dioxide equivalents in the atmosphere, but we're actually quite a long way above 400. These were always red lines. I think maybe some of you might remember the 360.org. So this is an aspiration that is long behind us. And therefore, once again, we have to ask ourselves, yes, if, as countries are showing us, inventories of greenhouse gas emissions are going down, why is it that the carbon dioxide equivalents in the atmosphere continue to go up? Is it that the planet itself is no longer able to function in the way that we had known in the past? So these are questions that we will continue to come back to, and therefore ecosystems such as coral reefs are really crucial. And then we see some other phenomena building up. Ebola, other diseases linked not only to wildlife trade, illegal trade, but also the way in which wildlife is coming closer and closer to urban areas, and we are exposed then to a whole range of diseases which can really have subsequent high consequences for mortality. For example, in Nairobi, we have an abattoir for camels. It's being built. It isn't completed. We now have camels being slaughtered out in the streets. There is a large market for camel products, milk and meat and so forth. And we now have just completed a surveillance longitudinal survey, which shows us that we have MERS in that camel population. So it's a matter of time and care that these things don't suddenly escalate out of all proportion. So human health and ecosystems is really coming up the agenda. And again, the Sustainable Development Goals do address it, although I think in a difficult way, still in some of those silos. So one of the challenges for us in the sort of international community, but certainly in research, is to how to breed a kind of new way of doing research, which continues to bring different aspects of the same field together. One of the other challenges that we face going into the SDGs is that we really do have a lock-in on some of our infrastructure, particularly the carbon infrastructure. And one of the messages that will come out tomorrow when we launch the emissions gap report in UNEP in Geneva is that the quicker you act, in fact, the better in terms of us responding to the climate challenge. But it also addresses the fact that when you have lock-in infrastructure, there's a tremendous desire to just add a little bit more, to add a little bit more while you're waiting to make the transformation. And what we demonstrate, of course, is that that is really like the Concord principle. You have to bail out at some point to really think about what your transformation is going to look like. The focus on cities is relevant. I would say that not only are these the places where we consume a lot of things, but it's also the place where we can make the greatest difference. And if you genuinely want to take part in a positive discussion around climate change, please do read all the reports on the non-state actors, because if ever there were a group of entities that are doing something, it is the cities. The cities are really taking on board the whole agenda, and I think, if anything, they're not only more accountable because of the numbers of people who live in cities, but they're actually able, because of the revenues and the wealth that sits within cities, to do some tremendous and very amazing things that are highly innovative. So for me, the place to watch is in the urban setting. Nevertheless, we have huge unsustainable production trends. We're still losing virgin land at a tremendous rate, between 5 to 10% of land surface in Africa alone, for mining, for extraction of raw resources. That is simply unsustainable. And even when it gets into the production lines, we then have to deal with the downstream problem of waste. And just from Europe alone, we know that we have 36 million tons of illegal waste coming out every year, which is, in a sense, a manifestation of the fact that we're unable to recycle and to reuse much of the materials that we put into society. And then inequality. It's very, very clear that as we've gone through a global expansion, and you certainly have seen the footprint and the handprint of global development, we have seen an increasing divide between the wealthiest and the poorest. And so the idea of eradicating poverty by 2030, however one might define that, and there was a long discussion a week ago in Bangkok about what really does poverty look like, it's clear that we have to do something to address it. Now, you'll be pleased to know, or maybe not, depending where you are, that in the Sustainable Development Goals, Goal 17, there are tremendous numbers of different fiscal instruments, not just taxation, but looking through the eyes of the inquiry at different financial instruments from the investment side, from the banking side, doing business in a very different way. So the Tobin tax got sort of kicked out, but there are many, many other ways in which we will look at revenue raising, which seeks to make more equal the way in which we run societies. So those are very encouraging. What I want to turn to, though, now is how we go forward. How do we implement the SDGs? The SDGs are not the property of governments. Yes, they will report on these, but the idea is very much that this is a mass participation. 7 million people participated in the run-up to the SDGs. Yes, it was governments who sat and signed, we're going to do this, but at the end of the day, it's about us. It's about citizens participating. And so we really have to confront the idea that we have very many different models. There isn't just the scientific model of how we do business. There are many, many, many peoples in the world who don't have access to science in that raw sense and use traditional knowledge, use local knowledge, indigenous knowledge. And one way or another, we have to start to think of clever ways to blend those together. Now, IPBES, the International Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, is a long way down the road on that, deciding on what kind of guidelines we can use to do that. But governments are necessarily nervous, and so whatever we do, we have to really think about what does it look like from a constitutional point of view, from the rule of law, and how do we really get that knowledge embedded into a way where we can underpin policies and move forward. The key for us, certainly in the UN and for myself, has always been to encourage people to move into the world of open data. And I'm really pleased that in the sense of looking at and monitoring this since I've been in UNEP for a couple of years, we've gone from 40 countries with open data policies to now in excess of 120. That is a tremendous transformation that countries are realizing they have to put it out there. They have to show what's happening, not only to other countries and to accountable bodies, but also to their citizens. In Africa, for example, there is an open data platform, a policy which every African country has, in fact, signed up for. So I think not only is it encouraging entrepreneurship, it's encouraging new and innovative ways of handling big data, but it genuinely shows that you can make much more efficient decisions when, for example, there is only one calculation of GDP in the government and there's only one calculation of how much forest area instead of having multiples all over the place. So I think, again, bodies like Future Earth and ICSU and others can really help to strengthen how that number comes about. But then my job, in a sense, is to ensure that when there is agreement on what the number is, then we all share the same number and there aren't sort of multiple versions upon which to make decisions. Another thing that we see is the whole rise of citizen science. And here I must say that I would like to think that we were in the vanguard in the European Environment Agency in terms of encouraging governments. Certainly the US governments and others are thinking very seriously about how to bring citizen science into the frame. And so, for example, here you'll see on the right-hand side an air quality monitoring unit. It's very cheap. It's affordable, it's $1,500 compared to $250,000, measures exactly the same thing. Since we launched it, it's been a huge response because people can now see that a community can afford to monitor its air quality, understanding how bad air quality is in many parts of the world. So by enabling good science, affordable science, it really does encourage us, I think, to bring in some guidelines as to how governments and how we can actually use that mobilization of people in a very proactive and positive way. And in the same way, mapping, we've seen a huge revolution in the world of GIS, of mapping, of bringing data from the Earth's observation satellites and platforms, but now we have to use it. Many people in governments and many researchers are just not familiar enough how to actually manipulate and how to integrate data, how to assimilate it. But I think that we really have to become spatially savvy. And again, another good signal from the Sustainable Development Goals and the indicators are that they will be disaggregated by sex, by gender, by age where necessary, but primarily and also by space. It is crazy to have an indicator that talks about, for example, air quality in a country and you give one number. It just doesn't make sense. So this is, in a way, the revolution that many of us have been waiting for, that geographical instinct that we know needs to be there to inform good decision-making is finally going to be upon us, and we will have to work very hard to deliver it. But, and here's the next challenge, we all speak in many languages. Yes, for example, in UNEP Live, we run it in 93 languages, but it's not language per se, it's the conceptual disciplinary differences. So if you look at the goals, you'll find that there are 23 different meanings of the word access to basic services. And we had a very long discussion, I can tell you, about what constitutes a basic service, what constitutes access, and actually how do you go out and measure it. So we have launched the SDG Interface Ontology. So there are 3,000 to 4,000 ontology engineers working on this, participating with scientific communities to really pin down what do we mean when we use a word, because it matters now if you want machines to talk to machines and data to be used in these ways. So let me end. Resource efficiency. It is probably the driver of much of the change that we're talking about. How to use things, not just in an efficient way, but when you have scarcity, you become highly innovative. And so there is a divide between the developed world that might consider water efficiency as just using less in a product, as opposed to resource efficiency, water efficiency, when you haven't got any water and you're trying to use water productivity or drip irrigation or so forth. So the leitmotif of resource efficiency is really crucial. I want to just give you a hint, though, of trouble afoot, if I might. And this comes from a completely different field. This comes from the health field. And the salutary tale that we see here, and I'll just summarize it. A fantastic scientist who some of you all know, Philippe Grandjean, has published more than 400 or 500 articles, published papers in the peer-reviewed literature on the impacts of mercury and lead on human development, on fetal development, on human health. But as he said, he could have stopped polishing the stone of science after about 150 papers, because what was added thereafter really didn't fundamentally change the understanding that these things are bad for you. And what this shows here is it takes a very long time, and it has taken a long time, to get from science, which is emerging, to science which is, so to speak, accepted by the broad community, into policies and then into implementation. Minamata, we knew 50 years ago that it was not good for you. We've only just signed the Minamata Convention 50 years later. So we don't have those kinds of timescales at our disposal when it comes to dealing with the planet and trying to make sure we have a sustainable future. So yes, we need innovation, but we need to be able to deploy that innovation, maybe in a slightly less risk-averse world, because the risks of failure are far too high. The risks of succeeding are always there. And if we actually exert ourselves to work together, as opposed to always in silos, looking for those medals, I have to say, but anyway, peer-reviewed papers and so forth, and really neglect the idea that this is a common exercise in defining what is good for the planet and for the future, I think we will be in deep trouble. So I hope that science will take a leap forward and actually develop the co-production of knowledge and a collaborative way of working. Thank you very much.